Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. It's only been a week since the terror attack on two mosques in New Zealand, but in that time we've seen the better aspects of human nature demonstrated in the outpouring of support for the victims and their families. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has been particularly recognised for her compassion and leadership. We'll hear in a moment about a demonstration of support taking place on the streets of Dublin this weekend. We'll also hear tonight from Susanna Healy, author of The 7-Day Soul, Finding Meaning Beneath the Noise. And also with us is Father Dermot Mansfield. Dermot has a lifelong interest in the story of Blessed John Henry Newman, who's set for sainthood. But first, on the line is Rima Halfawi of Calling All Allies. Rima, welcome to The Leap of Faith. In fact, we spoke before on our Christmas Day programme. Rima, what's happening in Dublin tomorrow, Saturday?
Basically, for Saturday, we're planning an event. We're meeting at the Spire at 5 o'clock. And it is just to let all people of Ireland know and to stand together against the violence we see today. So it's a demonstration of solidarity and peace. We've got Muslim representatives. We've got representatives from the community. And we'll be walking side by side, ending with allies holding posters saying, "I will keep watch for you." And with the Muslim community praying. It's a community demonstration to illustrate that we are all just human beings with the right dignity and respect.
Where did the idea come from?
Basically, one of my friends, Rosie, sent a text to everyone. And we started talking after what happened, when we got the news of what happened in New Zealand. And I, for one, was heartbroken. I couldn't go into college that morning. I couldn't stop crying. Such a horrible thing happened, and the videos that were going around, and we were still trying to piece stuff together. And so she texted me and some other friends. She's like, "Let's do something." Do you know, because after the aftermath, after kind of the news got out and everything settled, we got messages and texts and emails from friends that were saying, you know, "I saw what happened. I'm so sorry. I hope you're okay. This is so horrible. I'm reaching out and kind of there for you." And through all that was happening and all the sadness, it was kind of like a little hope, a little light of hope, that we're not alone, that we're not, the whole world views Muslims as these kind of, you know, outcasts, and it's not an us versus them narrative as, you know, kind of some media outlets would like you to believe and some politicians would like you to believe. And I suppose that's where it came from. It's not a Muslim-led demonstration. We're teaming up with so many different organisations, and that's where it came from, and that's why our name is Calling Our Allies.
But that us versus them narrative did get firmly established over the last period of time. I suppose what you're trying to do now at this point is draw attention to the fact that the general population haven't accepted it.
Yeah, we don't. And it was seeing kind of media come out and certain media outlets saying, calling him an angelic boy who turned into a madman, and talking about his past and his family life and everything. And I suppose the majority of people out there are saying, no, call it what it is. It's an act of terrorism. It's an act of massacring and killing 50 innocent people in a sacred space. And I think that's what kind of hurt us the most. It was that through everything, you know, we all stood up and condemned and said, you know, during the Paris attacks or Manchester attacks and everything that happened over the last couple of years. And then it was seeing people being like, saying, "Oh, they deserve it," and, you know, like, and then having kind of the Muslim community also turn around saying, "Maybe we should get security for the mosque, maybe we should call the Gardaí, and maybe we should, like, see who's coming in, we shouldn't do open days and everything." And just seeing that kind of fear rise and divide a society that, you know, was going along its day. So at the same time, we had people come in and, as I said, you know, call and text, and people come into the mosque, non-Muslims, people we hadn't met before that aren't really a part of our community, come in and leave flowers and say, "Is there anything I can do? If you need anything, give me a shout." You know, we saw both sides of the story. We did, as college students, as young people of Ireland, identify as Muslim and as Irish, and we wanted to do something about it. So it's not what is portrayed out there.
Rima, what's your objective for the day? How will you know it's been a good day?
At the end of the day, as long as we get the message across that, you know, our allies do show up, and we have allies, and it's not just myself and Rosie working behind the scenes. We have a whole team. We've got group chats going, emails going, and phone calls going, and people making posters and banners, and we're working on demonstrations and speeches and everything. So just seeing it come together, and we did something, and we did something positive in something so negative and so heartbreaking. And, you know, things like this shouldn't be happening. And here in Ireland, the community that we were raised in as children, we are not going to let it happen. This is our home too, and we are part of society, and we have friends, and we have non-Muslim friends, and we have Muslim friends, and we have practicing friends, and that's what it's all about. We are an intercultural society, so our main aim you know, reaching out to the community. We reached out to different student unions, different societies, different communities, different leaders in our communities, different people that we looked up to. We were saying, hey, could you give us a hand, you know, throw us in the right direction? How should we go about this?
And for anybody who's listening to us who would like to get involved tomorrow, Saturday, what should they do?
Please do show up and just, you know, be there for us. We'll have banners. Our hashtag, if you can't make it, is I will keep watch for you, and hashtag calling all allies. So get that trending, send out a tweet of solidarity, of support and unity. And we're just kind of trying to say, you know, Islamophobia is an issue. We can't keep throwing it on the carpet. It's a time of anxiety and worry, and this is all about hope for us and bringing the society together.
So that's tomorrow, Saturday at 5 o'clock at the Spire on Dublin's O'Connell Street.
Thank you so much. I'll see you now. Bye-bye.
Rima Halfawi, thank you for joining us. Well, next this evening, if you've any connection with UCD in Dublin, you may well have heard of John Henry Cardinal Newman. In 1991, he was proclaimed venerable by Pope John Paul II. A decree approving his second miracle was authorised earlier this year and begins the process of him becoming a saint. Well, our next guest is Father Dermot Mansfield. Father Dermot's the author of Heart Speaks to Heart, the story of Blessed John Henry Newman, a book which plots the course of Newman's life as an Anglican, his entry into the Catholic Church, and his influence on the Second Vatican Council. Dermot, welcome to The Leap of Faith. Who was Cardinal Newman?
Cardinal Newman, first of all, was a Londoner. For the first half of his life, for 44 years, he was in the Anglican Church. In middle age, at the age of 44, 45, he became a Catholic. The Church of Rome, he entered it. He felt it was the living centre somehow. There's an old story to that, of course. And then he was ordained as a Catholic priest. He felt he was wondering about that because he felt he was ordained already. But anyway, he was ordained in Rome. He joined the Oratorians of St. Philip Neri's group, not a religious order, but an association of secular priests, founded them in England, in Birmingham and in London. And he went on in the Catholic Church, pastoral work in Birmingham. He was called over in the 1850s to Dublin to found the Catholic University. And he did well in very difficult circumstances, including difficulties with the authority, the Catholic authorities here. He continued in afterwards. He had to give it up eventually. But he remained on, in obviously, in Birmingham and all that. To some degree estranged from the Catholic authorities. That's strange to say in a way, but he was. But it was because he had a great vision in a way of what the church should be about in addressing the issues of the age. And that wasn't seen. He was considered by some very good people, including Manning, who became Cardinal in Westminster, who was a convert, like him, as an unsound Catholic. And that his views, there were others on Rome a bit that way too. Late in life, a new pope, Leo XIII, wanted to honour him, felt this he should be honoured, this person, and he made him a cardinal. So his last years, and that, in a way, if you want to call it, cleared his name, in a sense. He was a man of integrity, a man of enormous mind, great. I call it greatness of mind. Now, that could mean anything, but greatness of mind, courageously one to see things, a man of truth, a man of humanity, a man of prayer.
But let's go back a little bit, because you have to take us through the story of a man who was, you know, well-educated, ordained, as you say,
as an Anglican. Age of 23.
But became dissatisfied. What was that dissatisfaction based on?
It was perhaps this. You can only say things in a short time. There was no centre of authority in a way. Now, that might sound, well, did he simply need authority? There was something about the issues of the time that he felt needed some central authority. And he, for one thing, the Catholic revival in the Church of England was a big thing, the Oxford movement that he headed with other Anglican people who remained Anglican, John Keble and Edward Pusey. But in time, he wondered about, is there a universal jurisdiction or something in Christendom? And a phrase from Wiseman, who is Catholic, anyway, founder of the Dublin Review, about Augustine, it is the whole world that judges securely rather than one part of it. That set him thinking, and yet he all the more he wanted to defend his own church, which he loved, the Church of England. And he tried to reinterpret the 39 articles, certainly in a Catholic sense, even though they were polemical at the time, And his friends support him there, but one by one the Anglican bishops disowned him.
Well, it's triggering something in the back of my mind because we're talking about 1845.
We are.
To be a Catholic around that time wouldn't necessarily have been a very strong position.
It was like heading out into the wilderness. The Catholics then were just little groups, sometimes connected with houses in Lancashire. The Irish were beginning to flow in, and of course the 1840s later went on. Mm. But and then there were people from the Terror in France, all that coming in, religious order. They were welcomed, actually, at that time, you know. But he was heading into the unknown. He didn't know them. The only Catholic he knew was Dr. Charles Russell of Maynooth, who came over and saw him a few, and a lovely, courteous man.
Was he always seen as an outsider, as a convert? Was he taken to it?
He tended to be put to the outside in a way. He recovered his name in the national consciousness, in the English-speaking world, in 1864 when he answered Charles Kingsley, who accused him of dishonesty somehow in his thing. And he wrote in Weekly Instalments his Apologia Pro Vita Sua, A Defence of My Life. And it had an enormous effect. It was like a phenomenon. And with people like George Eliot, who had lost her faith, the novelist, not the, reading it, Thomas Hardy was reading it, others, the quality of his mind and the quality of his care and his charity for his Anglican and his all that Anglican, you know, struck them. This was a man of, I mightn't agree with him, but this is a man of great integrity and truth and faith. Not everybody would have agreed with him on that, of course.
You make reference elsewhere to the idea that maybe Vatican II should have been called Newman's Council.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, expand on that for me.
You can't just put it all that way. There are wonderful people who led up to the Second Vatican Council, John the 23rd, theologians like Yves Congar, de Lubac, some of the great prelates like Cardinal Sunens. But his vision of the church and what it should be in the modern times was like the one that was in Vatican II in those years. And some people used to say at the council that his spirit was brooding over the council. That's the way they put it. You know, they felt that. But his spirit, his vision of the Lumen Gentium, Christ, the light of nations, and in his church, and the church in the modern world, you could say in a way, etc. The laity, the universal call to holiness in the main document of that, the role, I don't know what word now, the role of the laity, but the universal call to holiness and that all that would have been very much in him, you know, what he was trying to promote in his time.
Now, let's spend a little bit of time talking about his time in Dublin, and yeah, particularly the Catholic University. I was walking down a street in the city the other day, actually, and saw a plaque saying that this had been the site of the first medical school.
Oh, the first medical. That was the most successful part, in fact, of the university set up, because it was recognised very early on by the Royal College of Surgeons and in Scotland and in England, and it got together a very good group of doctors and so on. But the overall thing, it was Cardinal Cullen, who Archbishop Cullen as he was, who asked him to come over, and he liked the idea of a Catholic university, a Catholic centre of learning in the English-speaking world.
His idea of education was to bring out people who were more generalists than specialists in their education.
Broadly
educated rather than...
His idea of a liberal education rather than just a utilitarian one, which is often the way in third level. He wanted people to have broadness of mind and a real understanding of different issues and of literature and history and theology. He felt that that's very important. A liberal education, that's the word, that might mean a whole lot, but it meant something where you were truly educated. He felt that's important for the human spirit, rather than just heading. He knew you had to be utilitarian too and specialise and qualify, you know. So he wanted to do that, and in a measure did it, but it was against enormous odds.
You speak about him as if he's almost alive, or that you've met him, or that you know him.
I think that's true in some sense, if we can say that, but he has been over the years, and even when I was writing the book 9 years ago now, it was almost as if he was there, and I knew what I was doing, even though I had to do it on a timeline and so on, and he's been there for me. And the fact that he's going to be canonised, okay, a lot of people are not going to be, it's not the end, beyond end all, it moves me deeply. And I think the person, the way he was vindicated in his life, even looking over it yesterday, but I went back over it almost brought tears to my eyes, that this person who'd done so much, somehow late in life with a new Pope who's vindicated. It just, and he also opposed or wanted or tried to oppose the definition of infallibility in the First Vatican Council. Well, it's not needed. What's this all about? It's coming out of clear sky.
Where did it come from?
It came from the likes of Cardinal Manning and others in England. There was Talbot, Ward. There were different people. It was almost their one view of the answer to the times and the attacks on the church. Declare the Pope infallible and that'll sort them out. You know, it wasn't... Anyway, actually, as it worked out, the definition was more moderate because they didn't get their way. The Pope has that infallibility which the people of God have, which the Church has in some sense. It was a more general... And yet it was focusing just on one thing, you know.
If you got 10 minutes with the man, what would you talk about?
I would just thank him for his witness in difficult circumstances, both as an Anglican and as a Catholic, and his vision of Catholicity, of faith, of the gospel, of people's lives. Do what your duties in life bring you to do. That's your road to sanctity. I would thank him for what he has been and his own integrity and goodness and kindness to people.
Dermot, is there a musical connection to the man at all, or a piece that you associate with him?
Well, first of all, he was very musical from a young age. He wrote poetry later, and including what is now a hymn across the Christian denominations, Lead Kindly Light Amid the Encircling Gloom. That was 1832, in a dark time in his life, and he was looking for his way forward. And out of that came the Oxford Movement and the whole thing, his leadership of the Catholic revival in the Church of England. Later in life, of course, the dream of Gerontius. He wrote that in bits of paper. It suddenly came to him an inspiration in 1866. Elgar put that to music in his oratory in 1900, and that became famous through that, The Dream of Gerontius. It's one of the best loved oratorios, I think, that's performed.
Well, let's listen to that now. Father Dermot Mansfield, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius, played by the Halle Orchestra, the conductor, Sir John Barbarolli. Finally this evening, with me now is author, psychologist and mindfulness teacher, Susanna Healy. Susanna, there are many books in a bookstore which will cover the topics of self-care and looking after oneself in a mindfulness way. When you sat down to write this particular text, what was your motivation?
I think I felt that there was a gap of something that wasn't being said. I am a mindfulness meditation teacher, and I felt very comfortable in it for a while, having come to it from my own religious practice of meditation, very sporadic, very here and there, just going to the odd workshop, etc. But then I found that in teaching and people inviting me to come into their companies and talk about mindfulness, it was only being sold as a brain training exercise. And that isn't fair to what mindfulness is. It's actually a deeply spiritual practice.
Now, if you look at the Christian faith, it doesn't necessarily have a great history of mindfulness and meditation, or does it? Am I making an assumption on my part?
No. There is centering prayer and contemplation, but it is not something that we're taught. I don't think in the Christian tradition it is great in terms of evolution of the self or kind of development of the self in the same way, for example, Buddhism is very straightforwardly about that. But I suppose Christianity is more about focus on the other and service to the other, which is, something to be very proud of. But in terms of evolving the self and meditation and that kind of thing, it isn't really there in a big way for us.
So what was the journey for you to this point here?
Well, I suppose as a psychologist, I came from my psychology background. I also studied the work of Viktor Frankl's logotherapy, which is a therapy of helping people to find meaning in their lives. So that kind of tied together with a little bit of, and the philosophy around that. And that then the mindfulness practice, and I was also interested in hypnosis and hypnotherapy and had trained in that. And so all of them come together in these kind of common threads about consciousness, levels of consciousness, of ways of seeing the world.
And did all of that study put you in conflict with your formation as a Christian? Mm. Were you in conflict as a result of all the reading that you were doing?
I didn't see any contradiction or anything in what I was reading or what I was writing, because to me it was, to me I see God in absolutely everything, but I suppose in terms of my own beliefs, it is more, it's not so rule-based perhaps, even though I would attend Mass and I like the structure of that. But I suppose I would see it, I feel that religion or any faith or any version of God, ultimate reality, nature, however you might describe it to be, if it doesn't include everybody and involve everybody, then it isn't, to me, an accurate picture. So to me, I need it to expand out my version so that it involved everybody and the language included everybody.
On the front cover of your book, The Seven-Day Soul, there is finding meaning, but there's also beneath the noise. What's the noise?
The noise, I think, is the rush of everyday life. There is that urgency in life that we live by. It's almost like if you're not stressed, well, why aren't you stressed? You're not important enough. It's almost like we have a value attached to it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like if you were to ask somebody, are you busy? And if they were to say no, you'd almost be going, why? You know, and that's the way our value system has gone in life. But it has become too noisy for everybody. Everybody, to me, is just living on the surface. It's like I use the example in the book of the pond skater, just skimming across the pond, across the surface of the pond, and never actually seeing what's below the surface. So in this, it's about looking a little bit deeper, but in whatever we do. So it is not about taking time out of real life, as it were, to go and meditate on a yoga mat or in the Himalayas or whatever it might be. Often I find that finding meaning or our purpose in life isn't about doing something different. It's about doing how we do something. So it's in doing something differently.
I can see that it's almost evangelical for you, that you want to share this with other people as much as you possibly can.
Yes, I do. Because I really feel in Ireland, I wanted to call the book originally Catching the Baby. And that was because I feel that we have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. In terms of, because I think for a long time, particularly in Ireland, we didn't have any other source of spirituality other than religion. And as I say, I have religious beliefs, but lots of people don't. It just, and there are many reasons for that. And I just felt, you know something, spirituality isn't about religion, it's about well-being. You know, it's about our health. So I that's why I wanted to say, listen, because a lot of people kind of say, oh, but you can't talk about spirituality, it's one of those private topics. And what I say is, spirituality is deeply personal, but it's not a private matter. It really matters. And I was so lucky, President Michael D. Higgins wrote a piece for me, a contribution for spirituality and government. So I write about it in not only in our private lives and parenting, in relationships, etc., in the day-to-day, daily commute to work, etc., the mundane stuff, but also in our education system, in our healthcare system, in our architecture and public spaces, in business and the workplace and in government.
So if somebody picks the book up off the shelf, most likely, you know, what section in the bookshop is it in?
It is, well, at the moment it's kind of new non-fiction, but it would be in, basically, I think it's under psychology in most of them. Yeah.
And in there you have a very nice little model, which I just want to spend a moment or two exploring a little further, which is the idea of seven pillars. And, you know, without it being a things to do list, what's the foundation of that and what should people take from it?
The seven pillars are, I suppose, seven values or seven practices that I suggest we use on a daily basis, rotating, choosing one each day and going through the list of the seven pillars. The seven pillars being finding awe, forgiveness, gratitude, generosity, patience, humour, kind of a surprising one that I talk about it as a spiritual thing, but it is, and it's deeply connecting with us all, and finding stillness. Some of them less surprising than others, perhaps. But the idea is that you take one and you go through the list. Now, you can't just keep taking your favourite one or the one you kind of, you think you're good at. The idea is to get us to grow. We all think we're kind of above average on kindness. We give to the poor, we sponsor a child, whatever it might be. The idea is for us to try and evolve the country, our consciousness, whatever it might be, but each individual by individual. So we're only responsible for evolving ourselves by getting better at doing something. And often that's not, sometimes it's easier to give to the poor than it is to actually bite your tongue to your partner or somebody who's just really irking you at work.
So what I hear you saying is that a lot of people would refer to it as a stretch goal. It's a goal that's supposed to stretch the person outside their zone of comfort into something different.
Yes.
So don't stick with what you know best. Try something new.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what's yours for today?
Gratitude. And that's something, now gratitude isn't, that's kind of probably one of my easier ones, if you know what I mean, because I would actually, I do it with the children all the time. I do it as a prayer, kind of like my version of grace around the table. Now we would bless ourselves, but you don't have to if that's not your thing. But we'd ask the children what you're grateful for today. Now that might be when they're going to bed, or it might be at the dinner table, whatever it might be. And the idea would be that you can't be grateful for the same thing day after day, because that makes you put your radar on for, oh, I need to be grateful for something new today. Oh, I got 3 traffic lights, green traffic lights in a row. That were handy. The basic stuff. It's not looking for the huge stuff. It's just, it makes you tune in to the little stuff. You know, I got a car parking space, whatever it might be. The tiny stuff that's already here for us to appreciate. You know.
When we're faced then with a challenge in life, so it could be the breakup of a relationship, change of a job, loss of somebody we love, is it like a bank? Does that credit that you've built up over that period of time kick in? Is it available to you? Or can you still find that you're going to be hammered by something happening to you in life?
I don't think it can. I can't certainly say that it can protect you from being hammered by something. I think it does. I think the bank is a lovely analogy. I think it does give you something else, because somewhere, even in the deepest, darkest days, you have practiced, you've trained yourself to look for not only things that perhaps you're to be grateful for, or other people's kindnesses. So those little, like a little flower coming up through the cracks in the pavement that almost aren't meant to be there, the tiny shards of light coming through in the darkness. And I think that's where it just builds up a resilience. Can I say that it's going to protect you from the hardness of life? No. But it builds up a certain resilience. And it also, what I think, it's not about the taking, it's actually empowering you outward, because I talk a lot about self-transcendence in the service of other people. And I think that's very empowering. It's not to always kind of say, well, what's going to nurture me? It's to say, I actually, no matter what has happened to me, I have the power to serve other people and make other people's day better.
Susanna, thank you. And Susanna's book is called The 7-Day Soul, Finding Meaning Beneath the Noise. And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. From our producer, Sheila O'Callaghan, and me, Michael Cummin. Good night.